Hi everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Structural Heart Talks podcast. I had the great opportunity to travel to Edwards Life Sciences corporate headquarters in Irvine, California to sit down with some of their senior leaders and learn about their new strategy focusing on the structural heart space. In this episode, you'll hear my conversation with Daveen Chopra. Daveen is the Corporate Vice President of Transcatheter Mitral and Tricuspid Therapies at Edwards Life Sciences. We talked about the various valves. We talked about Edwards' approach in this space. Great and far-ranging conversation that I know you'll enjoy. But before we begin that conversation, I want to introduce a conversation our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, had with our sponsor, Resonetics.
Andy, welcome to the podcast. Really appreciate you taking your time with us today. I want to start by talking about your current role at Resonetics and the current location and site that you're at.
I'm Andy Paganaugh. I'm the Director of Strategic Projects in Bethel, Connecticut. I was part of the acquisition of Memory Corporation late last year, and I'm on the Lightspeed team.
Oh, so the Lightspeed team, that can you go into more detail? What is Lightspeed Lab? What do you do?
Lightspeed is the new product development group within Resonetics. We have dedicated resources that allow us to move really quickly, and we have really aggressive goals on quote turnaround time and prototype lead times. We're actually just setting up a new Lightspeed Lab here in Bethel, Connecticut.
So if you're setting up a new lab, what is your specific specialty and the specialty of the lab?
So coming from the legacy Memory Corporation site from the acquisition, we're really focused on nitinol materials and nitinol medical devices. We will do everything from laser cutting, shape setting, through to conventional machining and surface finishing of nitinol components. But our specific focus in Bethel is really going to be on orthopedic implants, surgical tools, and things like that.
Well, congratulations about your new site. Can you take us through the different orthopedic applications that you work on?
Yeah, I mean, we work on tons of different applications. A lot of them are focused on extremities. So looking at bone staples, compression plates, hammer toe implants for foot and ankle, K-wires, surgical drills. I mean, we also do a lot of things like suture anchor inserters for suture pass and suture passing wires. You know, the suture passer is actually one of the first FDA cleared nitinol implant devices. So it's been around for a while in Bethel, Connecticut here. We've been manufacturing those since the beginning. And these applications are rapidly expanding to other applications, for example, spine. You know, and our customers are really seeking to utilize the unique functional properties of the nitinol material that we work with.
You have experience with nitinol very clearly since the very beginning. How do you help companies get to market faster and improve the quality of their device?
Definitely expertise and experience. So you hit that nail on the head there. You know, we've been making bone staples, for example, for over 10 years. Suture passers and drills, we've been making for over 15 years. So we really have a good understanding of the process flows. We have optimized processes for all these different types of devices. We also have a fully equipped test lab. So for helping with some regulatory submissions, we do corrosion testing, mechanical testing, and we have the ability to measure phase transformations. In upstate New York, we have our Resonetics Smart Materials site, which is one of the first commercial melters of nitinol. So we actually have the added advantage as well, looking all the way back to the starting material and what net shape, if is it a unique net shape, unique properties that we need to start with, we have that advantage as well.
Well, that's great. We'll hear a little more from Resonetics later on in the podcast episode. If you want to find out more information about Resonetics right now, go to its website, resonetics.com. Well, Daveen Chopra, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it, Tom.
We've had you on our Device Talks Weekly podcast a long time ago. Yeah. At least it's probably a couple of years, but it seems like a decade ago. And I was listening to it this morning and I was shocked because I normally ask every guest how they got into medtech. I didn't ask you that question. I think I was trying to be like super fast news guy at the time. So we just got in, you had a recent approval and got out. So this is a fresh question. How did you find your way into the medtech industry?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I started medtech actually right when I got out of business school. I was before business school, I did my undergrad in biology, and I was always interested in sciences and things like that. When I came to business school, I really wanted to get into the biology or the science around healthcare overall, and I explored a lot of that in business school and ended up med tech almost by random chance. I had a friend of mine who was an intern at Medtronic at the time. He had a great time for a summer, and he said, hey, they have some cool jobs here. We're in the San Francisco area. You should apply for one. Went out, learned a little bit about the business, learned a bit about med tech at the time, and found a role and started med tech way back then.
What was the time frame again?
This is 2005, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, first started.
So the dot-com boom was not a big allure at that point.
No, it wasn't. It was past the crash. So it was more trying to figure out what to do. It was really fun. It was a good starting point.
What was it about the joining the industry that resonated with you?
Well, I love the fact that in med tech, and again, maybe I'm comparing it a little bit to pharma or biotech, mm-hmm. that I interned or worked a little bit in biotech where you had a product and you just had to almost market it and sell it. And you couldn't change the product. The product's the product because you couldn't actually take feedback from physicians and change it. And that's what I loved about medtech, mm-hmm. where when you could talk to a customer and say, hey, can you tweak this and can you tweak that? And you could work with an engineer and help make those changes and bring it back and actually help the customer in a reasonable time frame. I really love that.
Yeah, no, there's definitely more of a two-way process. Yeah. That's a great distinction. So you worked your way through Medtronic. How did you find your way over to Edwards?
Yeah, it was ironic that it's always a bit of a personal and it's always a bit professional. The personal component, I was living in Northern California and we actually went through wildfires at the time. And so everything in our area got kind of devastated. So I have two little boys and we were actually living in different areas and trying to find a place to even live where I was working out of an office that didn't get destroyed. And it was a good time to realize that the community probably was going to be rebuilding for a long time. And so at that point, my wife and I were open to moving because before that we hadn't been. And the professional one was actually, ironically enough, a previous marketer for me had moved to search and she was working for a search firm that Edward was working with. And one day she gave me a call and be like, I don't call you very often, but I've got a legit job for you. I got you something really interesting. It's working for Mike at Edwards, for Mike Masalam.
Yep.
And that's opened my door to kind of realizing, to learning more about Edwards and the history of this great company.
Without comparing apples to apples, but working at two larger companies, two of the larger, better known companies in medtech, I guess, are there similarities? Are there differences? How would you kind of compare the workplace?
Yeah, all great.
And I did I said you wouldn't compare it, but then I just said compare the workplace.
Yeah, you compare.
What are some similarities between
the big? All great companies, really dedicated to helping patients. That's what really matters. Mm-hmm. What I love about Edwards is our focus. I love that we're focused on structural heart and that our whole organization is driven around the heart. And so in that way, I can almost talk to anyone at Edwards and they know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We talk about our diseases, our technologies, because we're so focused. So to me, the excitement of focus is something that really drives me, and our focus and leadership at Edwards go hand in hand with that.
That's really unusual, too, to have that level of focus for a company of this size. It feels almost startup-y. So how is that resonating? I know you're in the process of spinning out critical care therapies. It hasn't happened yet, but have you received any kind of feedback from industry, from doctors? Is there any sort of?
I have actually from a couple customers, physicians who use our products. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've said and what people believe and what I believe is that this will just continue to allow more focus. And as a result, continue to be closer to those structural heart interventionalists. And again, this is a physician. So from their perspective, they actually took it as a positive that we're continuing to be just focused on the world that they live in. Mm-hmm. So they like that connection. And for me, I think that's probably exactly what the relation is, that critical care is an amazing business, one of the foundational parts of Edwards. But our ability to continue to focus on this large but relatively narrow area of structural heart really allows us to continue to innovate and lead.
So as part of all of this, as part of your having a new CEO at the company as well, you have a new title. You're Corporate Vice President of Transcatheter Mitral and Tricuspid Therapies, and I am reading that because I can't remember all that. The person before you who started the group, he's doing okay, so it looks like a good position for you to get in. Talk about the business, just an overview of what your portfolio looks like.
Yeah, no problem. This is a TMTT is our acronym. I know, so many acronyms, right? So TMTT is our acronym. So as you said, we are focused on transcatheter technologies for the mitral and tricuspid valves, so two valves of the heart. And they're two valves that traditionally have not been really treated as long transcatheter as the aortic valve or the TAVR business that's been around for much longer. And so we're really focused on bringing a portfolio of therapies that can either repair or replace the valves, mm-hmm. the mitral or tricuspid valve. And that's really what we're focused on, providing those new technologies to help people live longer and better.
Why have these valves previously just not been you weren't able to develop valves for them. Why did we focus on the larger valves first and focusing on these now? And are there differences?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think people know the aortic valve best because I think for many years, the aortic valve, which was treated surgically and then now treated transcatheter as well, mm-hmm. was known to have a really high mortality rate. And so people knew that they had to treat it and had to treat it aggressively. So transcatheter options were created very quickly. The mitral valve below the aortic valve started being treated a little bit later surgically, and the transcatheter options have been actually harder to create. It's more complex, both these valves. They're more heterogeneous in disease. So if you look at three different people with the disease all looks different. So there isn't as much as one single solution that can just solve everything. And like the aortic valve replacement does fantastic for patients. So part of it's been it's harder to treat the valve technology-wise. Mm-hmm. The other one, especially I'll talk about the tricuspid valve, which is on the right side of your heart, that's been not known until more recently to have as much an impact in people's lives. In a way, they kind of thought, well, if I treat the left side of the heart or the mitral and aortic valve, the tricuspid valve would get better. Or people didn't realize that by treating this valve or diagnosing the disease and treating it, that people would get much better. So they just never really realized that. So in a way, for many years, the tricuspid valve was called the forgotten valve. And only until the last bunch of years have people realized, wow, there's people suffering from tricuspid disease where if we provide a treatment for them, they're going to feel a lot better, which has been awesome to see.
Is it more difficult to access the tricuspid valve? Is it tucked away at the different – is it a difficult part of the heart to reach? Is it – what – just, I guess, the physical part of getting to it. Is it any more challenging than the valves?
Well, from a transcatheter approach, which we do, no, not okay. really. Actually, it's just as easy as the mitral valve. We go up the up the femoral vein and okay. we enter that way. If you're doing surgery for it, which traditionally is the traditional approach, this is actually a little bit of a harder of an approach from how surgical approaches occur. So, yes. But it's just because it's not the main pump of the heart. You know, mm-hmm. the left side of the heart's the big, the strong heart that pumps all the blood. People, in a way, just thought, hey, you can be okay with it. It doesn't have to be perfect. And only if we realize that, yeah, you can actually get a much better quality of life when it is in better shape.
So talk about your portfolio a bit. I mean, I think valves are amongst the coolest medical devices because they're built to replicate the human part that they're replacing. And you look at them, you can kind of – that's why I like medtech is like I could see something, see where it fits in the body, whereas biotech – can't see a small molecule. It's not as exciting as seeing a valve. So talk a bit about your portfolio and the valves you have currently.
Yeah, sure. So I start with the categories before I get into names. The categories are repair and replacement. And you're like, wait, there's two different things. Replacement is obviously you're putting in an artificial valve. So the body's natural leaflets for valve mobility are now smushed off to the side. They're no longer there. But we also try to repair valves. So keep the body's leaflets, the valve going, but just fix them a little bit. And they actually replicate more what's done traditionally in surgery for both these mitral and tricuspid valves. If I can keep the natural body's leaflets there and just tweak them a little bit with the repair, we want to do so. But many, many times you can't do so and you have to do a full replacement.
Okay.
And so for us, in terms of technologies, we start off by bringing our first repair technologies, this product called Pascal, which has been a great product coming in transfemorally that in the U.S. is approved for the mitral valve. And in places like Europe, we have it approved for the mitral and tricuspid valve. So that's been very excited to bring that technology. Most recently, we got approved for the first transcatheter tricuspid valve replacement.
Okay.
This product called Evoque, which has just been a fascinating innovation that it's only been about 5 years since we had first in human, and we're already approved in both Europe and U.S. So this is the world's first, transcatheter replacement for the tricuspid valve. So it's a fascinating. So for those that can't be repaired or don't make sense to be repaired, a replacement is right for them, and that's what we have now available in the marketplace. And we're also working on a mitral valve replacement, our first product to the market. We have a product called Sapien M3, which we hope to launch, in the near future. But we're working very hard to bring that to market as well.
And who are who are the customers that you're serving? What physicians usually?
Yeah, so the primary physician is the one who implants the valve. And those are the traditional interventional cardiologists who really focus on structural heart disease. Mm-hmm. But in the mitral and tricuspid valve, when you're putting these procedures, in addition to being an interventionalist who deploys the valves, you use a lot of imaging or echo-guided imaging, echocardiography. So the other important physician is the echocardiographer, which is a type of cardiologist who is essentially an imaging cardiologist who's also in that cath lab, looking at the imaging screen to help guide your echo probe that goes in you to help see the heart while the interventionalist is actually deploying the product. So it becomes much more of a teamwork between an echo physician and an interventional cardiologist working together, communicating with each other, versus just one physician doing it on their
own. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, that's fascinating. Talk a little more about the process. What is the interventional, what is the physician who's implanting the valve? They're seeing something. They're obviously, they're not just
yeah,
going,
of course.
You're being talked through. So what are they seeing, and what is the echo?
Oh, echocardiographer.
Echocardiographer. What are they seeing? Are they seeing the same thing just in more definition, higher definition?
Or a little bit different, meaning that there's two different types of imaging out to these procedures. Traditionally in the aortic valve, you just need fluoroscopy, which is almost like an X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
So the person who's the interventionalist who's using the device can look at a large fluoroscopy view and just see the X-ray and move the table around as needed to, or the imaging around to get the right viewpoint. But when you're doing a lot of interventions of the valve now, mitral and tricuspid, similar to what they do often in surgery, you also need this other kind of imaging called echo.
Yeah.
And echo trans TEEs is putting an echo probe down someone's throat. So that's why they're under general anesthesia, and essentially creating an ultrasound picture of the person's heart from inside of them. And so you now have an echocardiographer who has the probe put down the person's throat, and they're making adjustments to the probe to get the right viewpoint in the echo image.
Mm-hmm.
So the physician who's doing the interventions will see both the fluoro and the echo, but they can't also control the echo's viewpoint because they're not also able to be at the patient. So you have a different physician controlling one kind of guidance of viewing the echo, and the other physician controlling the fluoroscopy, which is the interventionalist. So it's this combination now. It's really complex.
That's amazing. And the heart's going this whole time. It's a moving object. You're not replacing a knee, which is a stationary fixed
object.
The
heart is beating the entire time. Yeah. And that's why these kinds of advances, you think about them, they've only been online in the last decade or so. These are things that 20, 30 years ago, we just didn't have the technology to do that we do now.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Is there an opportunity for some sort of, what sort of pre-surgical planning or pre-procedure planning is done to, like I said, if I compare it to a knee replacement a shoulder, they can have the whole procedure mapped up before they even go in.
Yeah, we do similar amount of planning.
Oh,
so,
there is?
Yeah, there is actually similar amount of planning where before the procedure, the patient will have both CTs, as well as echoes done in advance. So we get a lot of imaging in advance, especially for these complex procedures. And we often, if we get the imaging in advance, put together a pre-case plan quite a bit.
Okay.
We often work with the physician on this kind of plan. And so we can say, hey, here's the approach you want to look at. Here are things we've seen in the anatomy. And then we can work together and say, here's some things we should watch out for in the case. So we look at the imaging, understand which device we plan to use, put together the pre-case plan. And then we actually work with the physicians inside the operating room. So often in these cases, some cases we might have one Edwards person in the room. Sometimes we have two or three Edwards people in the room.
Wow.
One working with each of the imager as well as the interventionalist to help them work through the case and take our experience along with the physician's experience together, hopefully get a better patient result.
I'm guessing you've been through a few of these?
I've gone through, seen more than a couple of them. It's such an amazing, I am not a clinically certified person where I would do it on my own, but watching my teammates do this, it's just an amazing sight to see that kind of collaboration where the Edwards members are part of the hospital team for that case to work together to get the best patient output.
Now, that must be just really affirming to be in a room like that where you see the device being delivered and the care being received. So
it's fantastic when you get a great result. You see the physicians and people high-five each other and things like that. It's really awesome to see.
We're going to take a quick break from this conversation to hear from our sponsor, Resonetics.
So, Andy, I want to talk about the design and manufacturing challenges that have been associated with nitinol. But first, can you help us understand why companies use nitinol in these extremity applications?
So 99% of the medical device applications use the unique property of nitinol called superelasticity. So what this is it allows you to achieve really high strains with constant force. So it's different than a conventional elastic plastic material where those strains are much lower and actually not recoverable. So for a suture passing application, for example, you know, you want to follow a tortuous path, but you also want that device to spring back to its original shape afterward, right? For an implant, like a bone staple, you want to apply constant compression on the joint to allow it to heal faster, right? For bones to heal, they actually need compression. So that super elastic property allows us to insert that bone staple in by straining it and apply that constant force on that joint we're trying to fuse.
So let's now shift into the unique design and manufacturing challenges that are associated with nitinol devices. Can you help us understand that?
Number one is just understanding the super elastic properties, right? And how to achieve them, right? To get that performance in the device that you need. You know, comes along with that is heat treatments, right? To get those unique properties, you really need to understand the metallurgy and that link to the performance. Surface finishing is also very important. You need these devices to be biocompatible, right? So we've actually developed a lot of standard process flows over the years, and they've been optimized and proven again and again in order to help our customers get the ideal performance in their device. So we really are the leaders in the nitinol industry, and our goal is really to help our customers get their next generation nitinol devices to the market faster.
Well, great, Andy. Thank you so much for spending your time with us on the podcast, and we wish you the very best.
Well, thank you, Resonetics, for sponsoring this episode of the Structural Heart Talks podcast. Again, for more information about Resonetics, go to resonetics.com.
Well, we talked a bit about the reorganization at the top of this conversation. Let's go into it a little more deeply. What do you see as the benefits of the reorganization, and where does your business fit into it?
Yes, I think if I think about TMTT in the new company, we are one of the beachheads of the new company, mm-hmm. right? Ultimately, my business, we have the aortic valve business, and we have the surgical business, and we're all just looking at different parts of the heart in a very complementary manner. So TMTT just becomes, I think, a more important part of the remaining Edwards because it's more focused on the areas that we want to focus on. And I think this focus on structural heart allows us to continue to not only want to invest more in this space because this is the only space we're in, but it continues to deepen our knowledge in a way that I think appropriately we're ones who are willing to take more risk on because we understand the space really well. Mm-hmm. And so for us, I think as an overall organization where everyone is more deeply focused and knowledgeable about structural heart, it just allows us to run as a better organization.
It's going to be one of my barbecue questions. You're talking with someone at a barbecue in a backyard somewhere, and they ask, what is structural heart? What is structural heart? How do you define that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, I think it's just, it's heart disease related, not through vessel issues, mm-hmm. you know, not through the plumbing issues, mm-hmm. you know, they might have, or the electrical issues, you know, like in electrophysiology mm-hmm. or in coronary stenting or something like that. But I'm focused on the actual structures of the heart and diseases of those structures. So ours is not about an artery filling up with a plaque that needs to be popped open, mm-hmm. but actually as the structure of a heart moves and those leaflets around the valves move or other parts of the heart are moving and they have some kind of disease that prevents them from moving the way they normally do, the structures aren't quite working right, that's where we come in to kind of play and help them out.
How much of that do we know? I hear that and I think, okay, the heart, you know, it's relatively small size. We've developed valves for everyone. Yeah. Where is the opportunity for green space there? Is there a lot of things that can still be done that we don't know need to be done, or we're just learning that needs to be done? What can be done in the heart?
Well, I'll answer it two different ways. First, even in valves, where we've been treating them for over 60 years in some way, shape, or form, there's so much more to go, meaning that even today, there's so many patients who never have the disease awareness, never get diagnosed, never get referred, and never treated. Hmm. So even severe aortic stenosis, the aortic valve, which is the most established disease of the heart, we believe in the U.S. that only 13 out of 100 patients who have this disease get treated each year.
Wow, really?
Only 13. Because there's so many people who they're getting older, they're having trouble walking up the stairs, and they actually have aortic stenosis. Go to the doctor, and you're just getting a little bit older. Yeah, you're in your 70s, that's natural. But it's actually aortic stenosis slowing them down, not just getting older. And so that's why these diseases are a little bit tricky in that the awareness, referral, and diagnosis, awareness, referrals, and treatment is still really low. So we have a lot of work to do, not only on the therapy awareness, mm-hmm. but also in then continuing to create new treatments to get better results, like we're working on in my division. So I think there's a lot of opportunity just in valves. But then outside of valves, as we've talked about, there's the space of interventional heart failure that we're starting to look into, and others are starting to look into. And I say heart failure, as you know, is when your heart isn't quite pumping the way it should be. Ultimately, the walls are not quite doing what they're doing, supposed to be doing in the pumping motion. There are ways, and this affects a lot of patients around the world, there are opportunities for perhaps medical technology and interventions to help improve their lives as well. It's not quite valvular disease, related to valvular disease, but potentially has a lot of synergies with what we're doing. So we've talked about and starting to work in this space along with a lot of other folks in the space.
I'd like to drill down a little more on the 13 of 100 figures that you gave. What I hear that, and what I walk away with is 87. Those 87 people are dying prematurely because they've gone undiagnosed. Is that the way to understand those numbers?
Yeah. So similarly, that's the aortic stenosis numbers, but actually in mitral and tricuspid, the treatment rates are actually even lower than 13 per 100.
Wow.
And to your facts are, yes, many of those patients are dying at home or living quality of life that are just below what we normally expect. And those are the many patients who unfortunately never even get to a hospital and never get diagnosed appropriately. And then even today or in the past, never even got treated. At least today, now there's starting to be options for them, especially as I talked about the tricuspid valve, where we're starting to have options now in the U.S. to treat these patients who before you'd essentially just take a pill that would hopefully help reduce away some of your water weight, make you feel temporarily a little bit better, but just it doesn't actually solve any of the problem, and you're still feeling really bad every day. Now we have options to give you a medical device treatment that can actually rapidly and significantly improve your life and how you feel.
So what does that campaign to get the word out and reach those 87 people, or the figure related to valves, what does that look like? Because you can create the best devices in the world, but if they're not being diagnosed, they're not going to reach patients.
It's going to be a really big process over many, many years. Mm-hmm. And then, interesting, because in a way mitral and tricuspid therapies are so new, we see especially in tricuspid that a lot of these patients, some of these patients are already sitting at a hospital but just don't have a treatment option. So part of our initial job for the first couple of years is just essentially training physicians how to use our product, working them closely to get great clinical results, and almost in a way treating some of the patients that have managed to get to them. Mm-hmm. And then what will happen in the next phase is we're going to learn that there are probably other patients at their hospital that have gotten to their hospital system with symptoms but never quite got diagnosed correctly and never got to the interventionalist. So we'll spend a lot of time then working in those following years with hospitals to try to improve their diagnosis and treatment paradigms. And then at some point over time, which is always harder, you want to start trying to reach patients over time so that if they have those symptoms, they realize they have those symptoms and they go ask their doctor about it and try to get into that pathway. But a way for us right now where we're such an new therapy. We just got approval just months ago. We're just training our first centers. We're very much focused on that interventionalist and getting them trained to use our product right and almost attacking that those patients that are already right there. They're very close to that physician versus branching out yet. But over time, we're going to have to keep branching out to get to more and more patients.
What is it like to roll out a product or valve to for a replacement for a valve that previously had been untreated? Is it something that interventionalists embrace because they want to get at it? Is something that they need to be, and I'm sure it's all of the above, but do they need to be convinced that this is something that they can do and should do? What is that process of moving into a new area of the heart? How is that done, and what does that look like?
Well, it's a multi-year process that's well underway, meaning as I talked about before, the tricuspid valve is the forgotten valve.
Yep.
Wasn't really talked about much, but in the last 5-7 years, you start going to medical conferences and there's a lot of conversation. There's been lots of understanding of how many patients and how bad they really are. Then you start seeing the early clinical trial results from our therapies and any other devices as well, starting to make real differences. So there's been a buildup over the last couple of years. So with our approval in the US, there's been a buildup of energy for this where, in a way, we're trying to not have to convince physicians that they need to use it, but start that process of training them. And it's not quick and easy. It's not something that you pick up on a weekend.
I bet.
For us, it's one where to get really proficient and really use it, it takes months. And it requires really close collaboration with Edwards, where we help you in not only using the device, but understanding how that imaging component works in the cath lab. And it just takes time to do so. So right now, because we're in the early days, I think we have a lot of physicians very excited by it. And we're working very closely. We can with physicians to get them up and trained and treat their patients.
So where is the opportunity for advancement in that? Is there, obviously, the valves themselves you'll improve.
Yeah.
The delivery of the valves, I'm guessing that's pretty standard, or maybe that's something you're advancing on as well, the attachment of it. Where, when you're looking at innovation and new ideas, what part of that process are you focused on? I'm guessing it's all three.
It's all three. Yeah, I know you kind of knew the answer, didn't you, already? It's a little bit of everything, because for us, Ian, the technology we have, there's opportunities to keep making it better, both in what happens inside the valve as well as the delivery. Huge opportunities to keep getting better there. But as I mentioned in the beginning, these valve diseases, they're very heterogeneous. So no two patients really look the same. So despite our valve replacements or repair treating a lot of patients, there's still a lot of patients that the technology might not be quite right for because of how the disease manifests in the valve. And so for us, that's why we continue to have a portfolio of solutions and keep working on a portfolio of solutions. So we're not only working on improving what we have, but we keep looking at new ideas to treat some of those patients that don't even have a solution, even with their new solutions out there, if that makes sense.
When do you know when the valve is the right valve? Is it when they're in the heart? Is it during the pre-planning that you talked about?
It's the pre-place planning. So it's not during a procedure. So we know in advance quite often now that which patients make sense for our products, and we have a decent sense. And this is from all the clinical work done early on, and which ones, it's not going to fit in quite right, or it doesn't quite make sense, or it's just anatomically not going to work. So we have a really good sense of that for our pre-case planning well in advance. And so the reality is there's still going to be patients who don't have a great solution. So we continue to internally work on new programs and new ideas about different ways of continuing to attack the problem. Mm-hmm. And for us as an innovative engine, we look everywhere for good ideas, right? We sometimes, our engineers are working day in and day out with physicians and hearing from them about unmet needs. And that's really important. We're hearing about their unmet needs and brainstorming together solutions. Externally, there are lots of different startups in the space working in the areas who are also working with physicians, understanding the needs. So we believe innovation can actually come from anywhere. It can come from inside the company, come from outside the company. It's okay wherever it comes from. But our goal as a company is to make sure wherever the innovation starts from, we hope to then, if it's going to work, we want to be the one to help bring it to market and really help treat patients with that.
Is there an opportunity for innovation in the materials or the manufacturing of valves? Is that something you look at?
Oh, of course there is. Yeah, because if you look at these products, even our Evoque valve, right now it takes 24 hours of sewing to sew together just one of those valves. And there's all these very challenging pieces and parts to help put together. So we continue to look at how do we keep getting better and making these products easier, more robust, more durable, more manufacturable. There's a lot of continuous improvement on that.
I got to see the plant yesterday, and they looked like little tiny pieces of art. They were so
amazingly
well stitched. The final question about
R&D,
how is that done within AdWords? Are you working with other businesses? Do you have your own program inside? You mentioned that you're looking externally as well.
Yeah.
Just give us shine a little more light on that process.
Yeah, sure. AdWords is, driven around different business units. And we've said that for each business unit, we want a group of people who are just dedicated to the customers and patients in that specific area. So for mitral and tricuspid, we have a group of R&D engineers, people who run clinical trials, people who design clinical trials, people who help support physicians who just focus on mitral and tricuspid.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel like that we can really understand the unmet needs that physicians have in the space and that patients have, and we can help create solutions and create clinical data around those around these solutions to really help support physicians and patients in just our space. So for us, we really feel that the focus of each area is really important. And I think we do a lot of that, is really focusing on our areas.
And you have your own internal team?
Yeah, we have our own internal R&D team, our own internal clinical trial team, our own internal, all those kinds of parts all together, just on mitral and tricuspid.
So where is this all taking us? What do you see this sector looking like 5 years from now?
Oh, man, it's exciting, because I think overall you're going to see patients just continue to win as the sector works in the next 5 years. As these therapies kind of grow, I see at the end of the day, patients are the big winner, where more and more patients are going to get great treatments that may have not been available to not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
For us as a company, though, we're going to keep our commitments to things that we found really important. Like the first thing we've always said, hey, you got to start with amazing innovation. So we're going to stay committed to innovation in the next 5 years, where we're going to continue to invest in new technologies. We've also said it's really important to stay continued to clinical evidence, because even if you invent something amazing, if you don't have the clinical evidence to support it, no one's going to use it. So we're committed to continuing to do large pivotal studies, working with the FDA and other agencies to really help change the practice of medicine through the clinical data around the trials. And finally, we mean really committed that even after you bring a product to market, you've got to have amazing real-world outcomes day in and day out. So not from hundreds of patients in a clinical trial, but to tens of thousands of patients in a commercial setting. So we're committed to our field teams continuing to work really, really hard with physicians to continue to get great clinical outcome. So overall, this product focus innovation type of structure, that we're just going to stay really focused on that for the next 5 years while we hope patients really win at the end of the day.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing those 5 years develop. Anything I'm missing? Any final thoughts on something I'm not asking about?
Well, I just want to give a final kind of maybe shout out and thanks to all the folks who've been working at Edwards at the TMTT space. There's an amazing group of people who are just so dedicated to the trailblazing that is the TMTT space. It is really an area of patient needs where we at Edwards really feel like we've been trailblazing in support of patients. And I just really want to thank everyone for all their hard work on that.
That's great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Structural Heart Talks podcast. Thanks to the folks at Resonetics for sponsoring this episode and making it possible. Of course, thank you to the executives at Edwards Life Sciences who made themselves available for these interviews. You can follow this on our Device Talks podcast network. Subscribe to that. You can also check out these interviews in a video format on YouTube. We're working on more episodes of the Structural Heart Talks podcast for you, so make sure you're a subscriber and don't miss a future episode. Thanks, everybody.